All right. Welcome, everybody. Hey, somebody out there, give me a thumbs up if you can hear me okay out there on the panelists. Excellent. Got some thumbs up. Hey, everybody, thanks for joining us. And the background on what you're seeing today, this is a three-part panel. We have some experts that you're going to hear here in just a few minutes. We're all colleagues, and for the last several years, we have been accustomed to discussing our thoughts and ideas face-to-face at global conferences, and as you're well aware, that we haven't had that opportunity as of late with the rapid rush of, you know, going virtual as a response to the virus. And so on that point, many of us were having some informal discussions regarding, you know, our points of view on how this pandemic is changing our industry, not only today, but what that might mean for us as professionals in the future. So we thought it would be nice to share these discussions with you. I'll introduce the panelists here in just a few minutes, but today's topic is privacy in the times of coronavirus, gone or just beginning, and we'll talk through these, of course, coming up here. So before we move on, just a real quick review of some of the, you are sitting here in the privacy, of course, we're talking about privacy today. We also have two other webinars scheduled for you, and they're every Wednesday for the next 2 weeks. Next week will be cybersecurity, and then we'll finish this up with IT governance systems to kind of wrap up all this information. So my guess is most of you are already signed up for most of these, but if not, hey, keep an eye out on the social media of all of our panelists, because you know most of these folks are pretty active out on social media. So if you've even logged into your Twitter or LinkedIn account, you've seen something from them as it pertains to this webinar we're doing today. But let's get started and talk about the panelists. So I'm sure you recognize most, if not all, of my colleagues on this call today. This is truly a global panel. And we, as you can see, we have some very deep skills, and each of these professionals are very, very good at their crafts. By the way, I wanted to say that this is an unsponsored event. And what I mean by that is we're here as colleagues. We're sharing information with you. Our goal is to have a discussion and share thoughts. We will not have any commercial breaks selling anything. However, feel free to reach out to any one of the experts on this panel independently if you'd like to continue any conversation with any of the folks that you see out here. So who we've got out here? I'm Mark Thomas. I'm talking to you from the United States. I'm in the state of Kansas right now. We have Ramses out in Spain. We have Alan, who is from London, UK. Dirk is talking to us from Belgium today. Ed is from US. He's talking to us from Ohio in the US. Veronica is in Kenya. Alain is from the Ivory Coast. We have Opiemi from Nigeria. We have Dr. Ramsey and Dina from the country of Jordan. And finally, Kaya from Turkey. So you see, we have a really good global panel out here. So before we get started, a couple things I wanted to share with you. Please feel free to use the question and answer section. So if you have a question, because we have a lot of people on this webinar, if you have a question for a specific panelist, put their name in that question for me so that every one of the panelists can understand you're asking them a specific question. If not, what I'm going to try to do is keep an eye on the questions out there in Q&A. It might be hard to do on the chat because there's a lot of we get a lot of noise out on the chat. So I'm only going to look at Q&A. To be able to address specific questions. We may not get the opportunity to address all of your questions. We've got an hour and a half, and you guys know that some of the people talking in this panel, these guys could talk for days on this. So we may have to keep them short, and we want to be time conscious of this. And of course, I'll let you guys know this at the end of this panel. We are recording this panel, so you will have the opportunity to view this again. It will be available to you probably until the next panel we do next week. So we have that information available. We are not using any of your personal information, and we're not keeping any of that personal information. Obviously, we're talking about privacy. So what I want to do is let's go ahead and get started. We don't want to waste a whole lot of time, so let's do this. Let's jump in, and we have a series of questions. These are questions I've already sent out to all the panelists, so they've had a chance to think about it a little bit. But as you know, many of these folks are prepared to answer these questions right off the bat. So let's take a look here. First one we've got is considering this whole privacy, right? This is a big deal when we're talking about during and post-pandemic. How do you assess the impacts of current global uncertainty on your organizational privacy program? So I'm going to call out a couple of folks because I think we have a few of you who might have some specific expertise in this area. So I'm going to push this out to Ramses and Elaine. You guys want to kick this one off for us, please?
All right, sure. Thank you, Mark, and welcome everyone. It's truly a pleasure, a privilege to be among the speakers and certainly sharing interesting thoughts and insights into privacy in the times of the coronavirus, right? You know, I appreciate the question, Mark, because I think that when you mentioned uncertainty, you know, the definition of uncertainty came to my mind. Actually, the dictionary says that it's about doubt and skepticism, sometimes even mistrust, I should say. So I think that that resonates well with the times that we are living. Actually, the dictionary goes and says that it's the complete lack of knowledge or conviction about an outcome or result. So, right. You know, this is both a question and a statement. I mean, isn't those the times that are living, you know, that on uncertainty, what it will happen, you know, applications that are tracking geolocation. At the end of the day, and the question is very pointed, we have to remind everyone here that privacy is one of the pillars of any society. I mean, it's captured in Article 12 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So it's a right. But suddenly, well, I would say that and my assessment on privacy program, the goal has not changed at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's protecting the jewels in the crown, you know, the privacy and personal identifiable information, but the context has changed. So the goal in my assessment is, you know, you protect, you defend, you understand the impact of misbehaving with critical data. But, you know, these days the context has really changed in terms of uncertainty. So I would say that when it's about, you know, understanding the impact. And again, we will be talking, I'm pretty sure, in the next minute, you know, on geolocation, on, you know, my temperature, you know, when I'm boarding.
No, that's going to come up. You know, that's going to come up in a bit.
So that's my assessment. The goal has not changed. That's my statement. The goal has not changed. But there's a shift in perception, you know, on what we need to protect and how, and then technology plays a strong role. So that's my first answer, my friend.
You know what? I don't disagree with that. I'm going to push this over. Elaine, I hope you don't mind if I put you on the spot here, because, you know, so we just heard from a guy from Spain, right? And so let's jump another continent. Let's go to the continent of Africa and take a look from the Ivory Coast. Do you kind of agree with some of the things that Ramses was just saying?
Yeah, I totally agree with Ramses. The goal has no change, but the context has changed. And what I see here, even before this pandemic crisis, they were not very interested in privacy, really. It was not considered as a very huge issue. And right now, it's completely considered as secondary issues. The priority for the enterprise right now is to survive this crisis. And at the same time, as most of the enterprises are now shutting down, leaving, we see a lot of people who are leaving the enterprises because there is no money to pay them. The priority is now on other sides, and it's very difficult to convince the enterprises that privacy is still a top priority issue. They're focused on something else. So my point is, yes, I agree. It's still, the objective is still the same. It's still the same priority, but the context has changed. And the point is that maybe now it's not a high priority for most of the enterprises. And as you know, I am also in France. I'm both in Africa, in Western Africa and in France. And I see exactly the same thing in France when most of the major companies are putting a lot of people out of work, out of job, and they are focused on something completely different. And now it seems that privacy is not really a high priority for them.
Interesting. You know, you think about privacy, and then you think about an organization, and there is some liability to privacy. And you know, here's what's good. You guys might have seen, we had a question out on Q&A that said, hey, our team is working remotely. In our daily stand-up via Skype, the standard opening question is everyone healthy? Now, this may be something we'll cover here in just a few minutes, but I thought that was kind of an interesting point. Kaya already responded back and has been chatting back and forth with this person, but wow, my first response to that is, hey, I'm not quite sure I want to give you a status of my health, but I'm willing to tell you I'm safe. What do you guys think about that question? Would that create a liability for an organization when it talks, again, because we're talking about both as consumers and employees and users, we're also talking about companies as well, looking at the risks of our liabilities. What do you guys think about that one?
So I'm going to jump in there, Alan Goldman. I mean, I think if we look at organizations, you know, I kind of agree with Elaine's point that privacy is probably not the most important thing if you're a big corporate at the moment, although you shouldn't lose track of keeping that under control. But if you're a national health agency or you're a national health service, you know, and you're developing some of these apps that I think we're going to talk about in a moment, you know, obviously privacy is absolutely fundamental and really, really important. So I just want to kind of throw that in there as part of the context. I think, you know, picking up the point both Ramses and Elaine made about the context of privacy.
Yeah. No, that makes total sense. So we've got some perspective out of Europe. We got some perspective out of Africa. What about hey, Dina? I'm not going to put you on the spot here, but out of the Middle East, right? So what we call MENA, right? Middle East, North Africa region. What are you seeing in terms of some of the impacts to privacy around the Middle East right now? Oh, Dina, you're on mute.
Yeah, sorry. Thank you, Mark, for this question.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, actually, in MENA and GCC region, we have many regulations and many requirements from the regulatory bodies, like central banks and other regulatory bodies regarding privacy, in addition to other types of regulations like cybersecurity and IT governance. And actually, what we are doing here in the region is that we are trying to have all of these requirements under one single integrated framework, so we can align all these requirements and work with all of them together to achieve to be compliant with the regulations, in addition to add benefits to the organizations. So we have to balance the conformance and the performance, but in addition to that, we need to create benefit for the organization out of all of these required regulations and mandates.
That makes a lot of sense. And actually, Dina, what you just said actually takes me to the next question that I want to push out to you guys. Mm-hmm. And we talk about performance and conformance. Well, we have that coming up here in a little bit, but here's the challenge that I think a lot of people are running into. And I see this in many clients, and I'm sure every one of you guys are seeing the same thing. Well, we balance privacy and cybersecurity, right? How do we balance privacy and cybersecurity? Because what you hear on the news now is, and you guys know, we talk apps, we talk, is it okay, right? Is it okay for me, right, to forego my privacy, right, a little bit to ensure that I'm secured? Or how do we make sure we do a balance? Because they're two separate things, privacy and cybersecurity. Actually, what I'm going to do is Alan and Ed McCabe, I'm going to push this to you guys to get this one started for us, if you don't mind.
Let me see. Am I on?
You're live, man.
I'm live.
Okay, from the great state of Ohio. Is that what that big red O is?
That is the block O. 50-yard line at the shoe. I had to get outside today. So when we talk about bringing that balance between privacy and versus cybersecurity, you know, a lot of the times, and I've seen this with a lot of organizations where it's like, oh, we've got to focus on privacy, or we have to focus on cybersecurity, mm-hmm. and really. Cyber should be able to enhance and enable the privacy functions within the organization. Yes, they have a separate goal. They have separate requirements. However, as we mature cybersecurity, we should be seeing that cybersecurity is enabling that, especially now when we start talking about those privacy apps where we're collecting that sensitive information that here in the US, that regulated information as well as it being regulated across the globe. And we know from a cybersecurity standpoint, just by the number of breaches that we've had, that this is an area that takes some time consideration. So coming from my background as a former incident responder, where we had the first order of, you know, first do no harm, much like the medical community, what happens when you aggregate all that information into a central point, whether that's a Apple or a Google or a government entity. I was going through the news just recently, and I saw that in the month of March, just in the month of March, there were 67 data breaches that occurred that released over 800 million records. That's 10% of the world's population. You know, when we talk about collecting this information and putting it together, a lot of organizations want to believe that they're doing privacy right. They want to believe that their cyber's right, but we know that this isn't the case. And we're seeing this as additional and new legislation is being brought upon us, whether it's GDPR for those in the EU back in 2018, or the new California Consumer Privacy Act, which is California's response to GDPR.
You know, what's interesting is I think back to the Equifax breach, right? Because Equifax breach, fortunately, I was not compromised in that breach, but that is information that an organization kept about my private credit information. And I had no say in whether they had that information or not. And the victims of that breach, right? None of them said, yeah, Equifax, we want you to store our credit information, which is pretty interesting. You talk about all the breaches taking place. I think that's pretty significant. So Ed, so I think you opened a huge, huge subject when you talked about apps, right? This is the big talk right now globally. I think in North America, maybe New York a little bit more, but I'm not seeing it in the Midwest right now. Let's talk about apps, and let's talk about how we're balancing privacy and cybersecurity from the apps perspective. Who wants to go on that one?
Mark, I'm going to jump in there quickly.
Go, Alan.
I mean, I think this is a potential minefield. And, you know, all countries are scrambling to get these apps out there. You know, Singapore, I think, were one of the starters. We're seeing some significant issues and problems with these, particularly from a privacy perspective. And I think the dilemma is from a citizen's perspective. So, you know, you and me and everybody on the call, you know, are we prepared to give up some of our privacy rights to fight this virus and ultimately to save lives? And there's obviously a dilemma. So the age-old discussion around, you know, cybersecurity versus privacy, you know, the conflicts there are really being brought to the fore here. And organizations are struggling because, I mean, the problem is the more you water down the app to protect the individual's privacy rights, you know, whether it's centralized or decentralized, this app you're looking at developing or rolling out, the less effective this app potentially becomes in being able to, you know, do that tracking and monitoring and tracing, and the efficacy of the old application kind of breaks down. So I think we've got some interesting days and weeks ahead, you know, as I say, where countries are desperately scrambling as part of the fight against the virus and, you know, starting to release some of the lockdown restrictions. Obviously, the tracking and tracing apps are absolutely fundamental, crucial part of that. So,
you know, I think you're right. You know, I was talking to a few folks before we started this webinar. I said, you know, we're not at the point in the U.S., as far as I know, where we're being required to have an app to trace my exposure, those kinds of things. But I will tell you this is, if I were told I have to, would I resist? No. Would I be concerned? Yes. Most of us all say, hey, lives are important. But let's put it from this perspective is I'm, you know what, I'm willing for my email address to be exposed. That's PII. But am I willing for my birth date, my bank account information, all of my life savings to be exposed, right, from a health perspective? I know this is controversial, right? If it's the law, I'll do it. But it's amazing how this is an interesting thing, because I was talking to a client about this very subject, and one of you guys may be able to jump in on this, is they said this. They said, look, we're okay with loosening some of these rules to save lives. However, our problem is this, is once we loosen the rules one time, it creates a precedence that it's okay to keep doing it. What are you guys' thoughts on that one?
Mark, let me say something because I want to hear the rest of my colleagues, but very quick. This is Ramses here. So I just want to point out that history has shown us that this sort of technologies or controls, especially in technology, when they are applied, meaning when the motive goes away, hopefully when COVID-19 is over or whatever, I mean, the situation is over, if ever, I mean, those controls do not disappear. So if history shows us something, that it will remain. Actually, I was going to write through the chat, you know, what if it's embedded by default? And certainly, while I celebrate and I applaud that it's for the great good, you know, it's for saving lives, period. I mean, those controls, even when this is over, I mean, we are showing that it's possible, we accept it, we as society, we interiorize it. And again, I celebrate that. We are talking about the ethics of all that in here. We're talking about the limits of data collection, data gathering. And I think this is it's an instrumental question, an instrumental social debate, the conversation, I would say. So I wanted to point that out. They will never go away, I guess. Yeah.
Well, and you bring up a great point, Ramses, about never going away. And right now, everybody's focusing on getting this information together to fight COVID. What assurances does anybody have that once this is addressed, that they purge that data? Because now you're having very detailed information around who people are talking with, who they're communicating with, who they're around. And all of that is being centralized and aggregated into one area. So now you're able to build definite social networks and see, you know, how else can you leverage that data in addition to fighting COVID-19? You know, what assurance do I have as a user who's trying to make sure the health and welfare of my family isn't also being used for other purposes?
I have a comment about this one. First of all, privacy is clearly driven by the jurisdictional requirements. And if we look at, in the example of China, the Chinese government very clearly used people's private information to track the spread of the disease, and especially in Wuhan, to control where people were and who they were talking to. I have a personal experience. I mean, I was out riding my bike to the store 2 weeks ago along a road that was kind of controlled and under police control, and a police stopped me. And he said, "You can't ride your bike." And I said, "Well, I'm riding the store." And he said, "Well, no, you can't ride your bike." And we had a little argument. And he cited me. I got a $500 ticket for being on my bike on a public road. And then I asked the cop, I said, "Look, can I see your ID?" And he looked me in the eye and he said, "Mr. Kazmierczy, I know your name. I know your address. Are you sure you want to know who I am?" is what he said.
Wow.
And I just stopped. I didn't,
well,
you know.
Kaya, that has something to do.
There's something there. There's a fine line there, and it's a moving line. It's a moving target. So
that has something to do with you arguing with everybody. You know, I'm teasing you. Hey, so this is really cool. So you guys might have seen that I gave you a sneak peek at the next question, because what we've just done is we've uncovered a gray area, right? And so what we want to do is talk about, hey, how can we manage those gray areas of those conflicting concerns? So, you know, if you think about, as an organization, I'm a CEO, a privacy officer. We'll jump into privacy officer and data protection here in just a few minutes. But think about it. Organizations are using international offshore agencies, right? So you hear a lot about third-party risk. I don't want to jump as much into third-party risk as I want to do talk about how you manage those gray areas of privacy concerns when you're pushing this stuff offshore. And I think we've got a couple folks out there on this expert panel who probably have a unique perspective on it. So Kaya, you're one of them. And Opiemi out in Nigeria, I'd like to push to you guys on this one. How do you focus on these gray areas in an organization?
Well, it's really challenging. I'm working now with a few clients who are vendors for a global technology organization that has just rolled out a privacy standard for its information. And this global organization also offers a wide scope of cloud computing services. So what I tell my clients is, look, if you don't want to have them question the technology you're using, by all means, use your customers' cloud information services for your mail, for your hosting, and there's no way they're going to question that. You're not going to have a headache, okay? But is that the best to have some, you know, there's no maker checker controls that. It's all in one basket. The vendor is the same as the person providing the services, and the global organization is using a small vendor that's using the global organization's cloud services. And then as the customer won't question that. They'll say, hey, okay, it's fine. You're using my company, so it's all right. But I'm not convinced that they offered the best solutions. But just to avoid headaches, that's one way of doing it.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Kaya. May I jump in?
Yeah, please. Go ahead.
All right. So I just want to emphasize the fact that there's going to be increasing convergence of security and privacy. We know that even though you may have security without privacy, but you cannot have privacy without security. So there's a continuous need to integrate both the information security management system and the privacy information management systems of organizations. And I think the ISO standard 27701 has done a very good job, in bringing the two into focus. I also think that there'll be a redefinition of terms as we go on, in this era. The question is, when you say personal data, would that include your COVID status? No, because we're talking about global impact. Is COVID status part of your COVID infection status? Is it part of your personal identifiable information? Do you have rights to that information, or is it government record? Okay, so those are some of the challenges that we are going to be having. I also think that issues around reinterpretation of the privacy principles, the number of privacy principles, would there be reinterpretation of them in this time? So I think that those are some of the gray areas that need to be addressed as we go into the COVID era.
Anyone else have any perspective on this out in Middle East, Europe?
Mark, let me use another minute for saying something.
Come on, Ramsey. I knew you'd have something to say about this.
No. Very, very quick. I mean, when we talk about areas of conflicting, one of my sentences, as I traveled, or I was used to travel the world during sessions, et cetera, during session. My statement is the following. You can have security without privacy, but you cannot have privacy without security. So yeah, you can build a secure and robust and solid approach and a fantastic program, but don't care about privacy, which is it's a tragedy, I feel. But the holy discipline of privacy, protecting critical information, sensible information, PII information, so personal identifiable information. So privacy cannot be built without a robust and solid foundations on security. And I think that we have been throwing for decades things on security and identity management, access control, and etc. But then the whole discipline that sits on top, I would say as an overarching umbrella, is a privacy being built on top of a robust and solid approach on security, which I think is a nice statement. So you can have security without privacy, but cannot have privacy without security, Mark.
So it's an interesting point. One of the things that kicked off this whole discussion was, hey, we're offshoring, we're outsourcing, we're using a third party. So how important is it for us to put the privacy information in a contract with an outsourced organization? Can we actually do that, put a contract in place for that? And is that something that we're seeing across the globe right now? We're adding privacy as part of a contract or legal obligations for outsourcing right now?
Okay, for example, in Nigeria, there's NDPR, which is like GDPR, National Data Protection Regulation.
They see that in Jordan too, I think, right? Yeah.
So we have a government agency that ensures that certain category of organizations actually demonstrate compliance with the regulations and the rules. But my concern is that with global pandemic, who's going to be regulating the regulators? In this case, the government, interested in some of your personal information to control pandemics or epidemics, who regulates that? Then we're talking about public clouds. And then like Africa, for example, we depend so much on clouds that are outside the jurisdiction of the country. And we know that there's also some international politics and international relations around when it talks about global pandemics. You know, the president of the United States talks a lot about China or the, you know, and all of that. So what are the implications in terms of, you know, trust when it comes to transfer of data, you know, storage of data, retention of data, and I mean, especially the data lifecycle management in general. You know, I think it's something that from my region would be of a lot of concern, you know, because it has implications on immigration, it has implications on travels. You may have to get a COVID certificate before you can maybe travel to certain countries, I mean, you know, going forward. So I think that is part of what we need to begin to think about, and the implications on doing business, on doing travels and all of that.
So you just mentioned that there are organizations or countries requiring a COVID certificate. So as an organization who outsources, offshores, whatnot, and I'm recruiting, I am now recruiting. Can I require somebody before I hire you to have a COVID certificate, or is that private information? Right. This is not at you, LPME. This isn't the whole group, right? Because, hey, wait a second, is you can't, you, my perspective would be you can't decline me a job because I'm positive for COVID, or can you? To see my point there, I think that's pretty interesting when it talks about privacy.
Mark, I think this is a minefield. And I mean, I think the lawyers in the room or, you know, on the call or around the globe are rubbing their hands, because there are already organizations that are, you know, usually breaching stuff around this. And you talk about recruitment, without a doubt. But at the end of the day, I mean, it's really no different from what it was before, ensuring that those organizations handling that private data, personal data, have proper safeguards in place and able to protect that personal data. And they should demonstrate, whether they're corporate or a nation state, they should be able to demonstrate that that information is being properly protected against abuse by, you know, themselves, by other people accessing that information, whether they're corporates or contractors or whatever. And that, you know, they need to act responsibly, there needs to be transparency, there needs to be proper oversight. All those, you know, it's in a real, in a perfect world, no doubt, but they need to make sure they have that proper control and security around that personal data.
Also, yeah.
Go ahead,
Mark.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Also here we have a very interesting gray area to talk about, is about freedom and in addition to privacy. Now back in the Middle East and GCC region, we have a complete lockdown. And back to that thoughts that you said about using apps, using portals, websites to disclose all this privacy information or PII. Definitely, right now we need to balance between freedom. If I want to get outside my house, I need to enter my privacy data on several portals, several applications, which is eventually has been rapidly developed on the spot due to the coronavirus incident, and we are disclosing our information to many potential third parties, which is we have no clue about their security, how they preserve the confidentiality, integrity, availability of data, privacy data. So if right now if I want to go outside my house or drive a car, I need to have a special application with all my privacy information on it and the barcodes, so I will show it to the military or to the police, so that they will allow me to be free and to drive my car. So here comes balance between privacy disclosure and between freedom as well. So it's a very quite interesting conflicting gray area. I see it in privacy era.
Well, it does make a lot of sense. And so, Dr. Ramsey, so you know, you show up as Dina Newman on this. So I want everybody to recognize that the man, wave your hand, Dr. Ramsey. Dr. Ramsey, that is not Dina, right? Just so you guys know.
I wanted to tell you about that, but
he hijacked Dina's personal account, and he violated her privacy to join this call.
Exactly.
I'm teasing you guys. So that takes me to another question, and I want to stay with you guys, with Dina and Dina, or in this case, Ramsey and Dina. And I want to bring Dirk out in on this as well, because we're talking about frameworks next, and right, different things like that. Is I want you guys to kick off kind of a discussion about, hey, if I'm a CIO, if I'm a CISO, if I'm a DPO, whatever my role is in an organization, hey, is there a single reference point we can go to out there to help us navigate this minefield that Alan mentioned before? And I don't disagree with him. What do frameworks do to help us out in this kind of stuff? I'd like to kick off with Jordan, because I do understand the situation you guys are in, Jordan, having worked with you guys in the past. And I want to push to Dirk, because Dirk is, I would say, a framework specialist when it comes to looking at these types of issues. So sorry to put you on the spot, Dirk, but we'll start with Ramsey and Dina. Go for it, guys.
Yeah. So eventually, back in the Middle East, we are operating at a very highly regulated environment, and there is many regulations that has been published since 2017 relevant to the protection of banking industry data, to privacy data, payment card industry data as well. So we have here, for example, in addition to the governance of enterprise INT as well, regulation that has been published to maintain a single entity. Integrated framework around the protection of privacy data in the Middle East. So we are having here from central banks and regulatory bodies the payment card industry as a mandatory standard to apply to secure the payment data and privacy data of them. And users, in addition to ISO requirements, EU GDPR has become mandatory back in our region, but with a Jordanian or let's say regional flavor. So they remove the fines and they replace it with another potential consequences if you are not following those standards or regulations. And from here evolved, I think the need for a single integrated framework such as COBIT 2019 that is aligned with international standards. We can build our cybersecurity resilience roadmap in alignment with COBIT 2019 to build governance and security and have this balance around it. What do you think, Dina, about that?
Yeah, exactly. I totally agree with you. Having a single integrated framework or reference for all of these regulations and requirements is a must now. And if I'm going to discuss this about COBIT, I totally agree with you, because COBIT is a good reference, especially with its latest edition by ISACA, COBIT 2019. We already have a new process introduced in that framework related to the managed data, in addition to other processes or objectives related to security services, and business process controls. In addition to that, in the design of the governance system according to this framework, COBIT, we have a step in the design where we can add certain governance topic to the IT governance. One of the governance topics or focus areas that has been also mentioned by in this framework is the privacy, data privacy. So I totally agree with you that we need to have single framework or single reference for that. COBIT can be a good start. While working on the focus area in this framework, definitely we can map and reference other frameworks and standards like ISO, PCI, cybersecurity, and others. So this is exactly actually what we are doing here in Jordan. We have the governance framework is required for IT, we have privacy of data is required, cybersecurity, PCI, and others. And they are all, we work on them under one umbrella, which is COBIT 2019, while having different focus areas, one of them for data privacy. So I'm not sure, what do you think, Derek, about that? Because you are our expert in this framework. Yeah.
You are muted, Mark. You're muted. You're still muted.
Hey, Dirk, we can't hear you. I think it doesn't show you're muted. Can you guys hear Dirk?
No.
No.
We heard him earlier.
I'm back, Mark, to the until Derek will figure it out. And back to the topic that nowadays, especially managed business continuity during the coronavirus incident, the whole governance system and the single integrated framework, COVID, and with all its alignments, are under stress testing. Everybody is testing their business continuity, their disaster recovery plans. They are doing continuous cybersecurity testing, pen testing, vulnerability assessment for their environment. For their, they are also measuring and working on applying their teleworking policy in a secure approach, whether they will use Zoom, Teams, TLS 1.2, whatever security protocols they will use to protect their privacy data. So I think having using a single integrated framework with alignment with many references will really help many organizations during the coronavirus.
Do want to get Dirk in here. So it shows Dirk was, because we're talking frameworks here. This is a guy that I want to jump in on this one. Nope, can't hear it. So for some reason we heard Dirk earlier when we were doing the sound check, but maybe depends on what you got going. So did we lose Dirk? He might come back to us in a few minutes. So we'll hit Dirk here in just a few minutes because I think it's important to talk about this. So here's what's interesting, though, is if you look, and a lot of people say, well, GDPR kicked off the global privacy kind of craze, but that was from a compliance perspective only, right? And I think GDPR, I think there are a lot of, and I hate to overuse the word gray areas in GDPR, but what are you guys seeing around the globe right now when it comes to your national privacy type of legislation? GDPR being global, it hits everybody. Jordan, Spain, Euro, right? Africa, right? Are we seeing, is GDPR a standard for privacy, or are you creating more detailed privacy concerns in your countries? Here's my example. Is our concern in North America is this, is GDPR, right? Great. Next thing you know, New York creates a privacy standard. California creates a privacy standard. Next thing you know, I'm going to have 50 U.S. states with different privacy standards. And as an organization, I can't manage all that compliance. What are you guys seeing around the world? We'll start with Turkey.
The one thing that I see, we have a new bank regulation for IT controls. And the one area that it distinguishes in privacy is sharing private information internationally. That's mm-hmm. the one place where it's very clear, you know, no bank is allowed to share deposit holder information with any global cloud provider. All that information can only stay within the borders of Turkey. That's mm-hmm. the one area that it changes. And that's the one thing I've seen that really distinguishes all the privacy frameworks I've read. Most of them, you know, talk about, hey, you know, disclosure, of whatever private data is being collected, or make sure that there's good reasons for having that, getting the active consent from the private data owner about how that data is going to be used, how the information is going to be used, who the information is going to be shared with. Again, the one distinction we have locally is whether it's shared with international organizations or local ones. And the bank regulator has actually gone out and written to the independent auditors very clearly and said to the Big Four and said, look, you need to look at this in banks, especially with vis-a-vis the bank's work with social media marketing agencies. You have to absolutely guarantee that that information, that private data, is not being shared internationally. So that's the one thing I've seen that is a distinguishing point between a lot of the frameworks. Most frameworks don't mention that point, but the ones that we have locally do.
Got it. Hey, so Ed McCabe, I'm gonna single you out here. What are you seeing in North America from this perspective?
Let me get off mute. So yes, we're seeing a lot of different requirements. And like you mentioned, you know, yes, I absolutely see us having 50 individual, unique, state-sponsored privacy requirements because everybody in every state is special.
Yeah.
But in addition to that, I mean, you know, NIST just released their, was it the new privacy framework that they had?
Recently, yep.
You can also go back to the tried and true. I love the ISO standards, although that has not been embraced well here in the U.S. with 19600. Is it 19600? But we need to have these frameworks available, at least to give us options to be able to move forward. Otherwise, we are going to have a fractured compliance program within the enterprise. Think about your larger medical institutions. You know, if somebody's on vacation from California and I'm treating them here in Ohio, now I have to manage not only to Ohio standards, but also HIPAA. And oh, by the way, because they're from California, I have to protect them under that as well.
No, that totally makes sense. Hey, I'm jumping to you, Alan. Let's hear what we got in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, I think UK is, UK is quite instrumental in the behind the whole GDPR, and we've always had a fairly mature kind of privacy regime. Having said that, you know, some of the things are open for open to interpretation, and I guess what we're seeing is that there is, you know, guidance provided by the Information Commissioner's Office on many, 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 many different areas, and countries are going to differ. There are going to be some, you know, slight differences depending on cultures. For example, Germany has always been very, very strong in privacy, and are probably more restrictive than in some other countries around Europe. So we're definitely seeing some subtle differences. But, you know, GDPR 2 years down the track now, I think is fairly well understood.
I think so.
But you know, it really does depend on cultural differences across jurisdictions, I think.
I think so. Speaking of cultural differences, Elaine, I'm going to jump to you. You span Africa and Europe. So what are you seeing on your end when it comes to this?
From the Europe point of view, I completely agree with Ellen. There are different point of views in Europe, but globally, GDPR is well respected. When we jump to Africa, you have two parts in Africa. You have the French-speaking countries who are completely aligned with what is done in France. And you have English-speaking countries which are more aligned with more strict regulations such as German or UK regulations, which are very well aligned to GDPR. In French-speaking countries, the main issue for the governments is to control all the personal data of the people and to be ready when necessary to shut off the internet access to avoid some problems. So in French speaking countries, we see it's not mature, and the only regulation which is applied and which is not very well applied, it's GDPR, but with a lot of holes regarding the application. And it's done only for the organizations which must exchange their data with Europe, but for most of them, we don't care, really.
So, Stay, you talked about a little bit of Europe, you talked a little bit on the Africa side. Hey, Ramses, I'm going to jump to you. You probably have a perspective from the European perspective on GDPR. Let's hear it.
Sure, thank you very much, Mark. So a couple of reminders for everyone. I know that everybody probably knows that, but I mean, it's not a directive GDPR, it's law. So just out of the box is 28 countries that have to abide by the law. So you don't transpose the directive, actually it's law. Another thing that we have to remind everyone that the aspiration of the regulator, and I was there working with the Article 29 Working Party, I mean with the EU when it was drafted, you know, I was there at the beginning when it was drafted in 2015 and 16. And you know, it's funny because the goal was to protect the Europeans and data from Europeans around the globe. Another thing is how it can be enforced, you know, in Australia. How are you going after the US if someone is misbehaving with data? But the aspiration...
They're going after money, right?
Yeah. But it's a European law with an international aspiration, which I think it's interesting these days. Another thing that I want to point out is that, you know, I have been working with the government in South Africa. They have POPI or POPIA, so Protection of Privacy Information Act, you know, which is basically...
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Out of Africa, you said, yes?
Correct. But it's basically a GDPR copy and paste with a couple of tweaks here and there. Basically, the goal is quite literally the same. In Chile, you know, in Latin America, basically the same, copy-pasting with a couple of tweaks here and there. So at the end of the day, we have to realize that the goal is always protecting the jewels in the crown, which is, you know, the sensible information and relevant information. Another thing that I want to say before I give the floor to other my colleagues here is, you know, I love the U.S. I have been in Washington, and I can't remember how many times. And in the World War Memorial, in the First World War Memorial, you know, around Washington, I mean, it's written on the wall. And again, I'm not endorsing the quote, but I think it's very relevant for today's webinar, which is, it's literally written there, freedom is not free. Again, I'm not endorsing the quote, but I mean, it's like saying safety is not free. You want to be protected? Well, I need data. You want me to prevent the next big thing as a government, as an institution, association? Well, I need to know. And again, I'm not talking about the limits in here, or I'm not endorsing it, yes or no, but I think it's very good food for thought. I mean, freedom is not free. I need to know what's next in order for me to protect you, if I'm government, et cetera. So I think that safety is not free, you want to protect. So I think that's a very relevant food for thought for the webinar, Mark.
Well, I think that absolutely makes sense. And as a matter of fact, you mentioned Africa and privacy. We've got a couple of folks here from the continent of Africa. I'm going to single you guys out. Opiemi, Veronica, Elaine, you've already given your perspective on this. Let's hear what you guys think. Veronica, go for it.
Okay, Veronica, after you.
All right, thank you, Mark. Yes, in Kenya, we have the Data Protection Act. It was enacted last year, 2019. Most of the provision in the Act were actually borrowed from the GDPR. The only unique thing I see is that the provisions require establishment of an office of a data commissioner. That's the only something that is a bit unique. Yeah, but most of the provisions in the Act were mostly borrowed from the GDPR. Back to you, Mark.
Opiemi, go right for it, man.
Yeah, so Veronica is in the east of Africa. I'm from the west of Africa. And both countries were colonized by the British. So we align with the GDPR. And the NDPR, the Nigerian version of GDPR is NDPR, was enacted last year, and the enforcement has started this year. So in Nigeria is the largest economy in West Africa, or probably in Africa, and Kenya is the largest economy in East Africa. And I think that the two nations are setting the tone around privacy, but it's actually in its infancy. You know, people are getting more aware, professionals are getting to learn about it. And I also think that the new standard from ISO 27701, would be something that African countries would like to adopt, because we tend to be more interested in international standards as against going for American standards, European standards, and all of that. So I see consensus emerging and growing around the international standards from the ISO organization. Yeah.
That makes sense. So we got the east side of Africa, the west side of Africa. So Alan Boardman, I know you do have a connection on the South Africa side, if I recall. Any perspective from some of your colleagues on the South Africa side?
Yeah, so I know POPI, I mean, Brandt has already mentioned POPI, which is the kind of GDPR equivalent. I can't remember if it's already live or people are still kind of getting ready for it. But my understanding is that it's not that dissimilar from GDPR, as Ramses mentioned. I'm a little bit out of the loop on what's happening on the ground.
Ramses, it moves fast, doesn't it?
So I'm going to revert back to Ramses to probably give a more detailed explanation.
Thank you, Alan. Actually, I can tell you that it's progressing. Of course, there's always room for improvement. But there's this sort of consciousness from the country itself, from banks. Of course, you know that I work, you know, in a vendor. So we're doing a lot of things these days with privacy. So I would say that they are actually, the acronym has changed a little bit. I'm not saying that it's a second version, but they added an A, like an act. So it goes Poppy at the beginning. Now it's Poppy A, so the act. But I mean, there's some sort of going on, moving forward. We need to do it as a country, and probably the largest country in Africa, right? So I can tell you that, of course, there's always room for improvement. But if you ask me this question, like, 2 years ago, when GDPR came into effect, you know, May the 2018, I would say, well, not in Africa. I would say now, I mean, there's this sort of feeling that we need to. Actually, I would say for you and for the rest of my colleagues, and of course, attendees here to the webinar, is actually, I am seeing a trend, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm seeing a trend of privacy as a competitive advantage. You know, I mean, privacy as, if I do it well, if my privacy program is robust and solid enough, customers will come. You know, I mean, of course, we provide surveys, but if it's good here and I'm protected, I feel at home, you know, sort of. So I think it's a beautiful topic.
Wow.
To discuss.
Yep. Wow, that's huge. Privacy as a competitive advantage, right? So that throws a couple of very large social media platforms out of the picture, right? Social media platforms that every one of you guys use. I tell you guys what, let's do this. I need to move forward a little bit. I think we hit a lot of information on that. And I think what we all agree is, hey, we've got a global law, right? There's a legal precedent around GDPR. Right now, most countries are struggling with trying to figure out how we're creating our standards around this and the legal representation around privacy. The U.S., we're about to deal with, like Ed said, 50 different state laws. I think that folks on this call have enough influence that we can actually start to look at how we create a single picture. Because when GDPR came out, and like you said, Ramses, this wasn't law until just, a year and a half ago, just over 2 years ago. I think it's a great starting point. And I think the EU actually hit some people in the head and said, you need to start thinking about these things and that we had not thought about before. So I think that's a great kickoff point. So next thing I want to do, and this could get real deep. We'll see how this goes. But again, we want to make sure we get everybody out on time. What suggestions would you have for a newly appointed privacy officer, considering these global conditions? This is tough because a privacy officer, DPO, whatever role you want to call it, this is an executive role that is accountable now for privacy of not only their own employees, but the privacy of the consumers, the customers, right? And so on. So I think this is a good one. So Ramses, I know we've heard from you. We got some great information from you. Dirk, it looks like Dirk may have dropped because we couldn't hear him earlier. Ramses, you want to kick this one off?
Yeah, sure. And let me start with a joke, if I may. I mean, my suggestion for a newly appointed privacy officer, pray, you know, I mean, just joking.
No, that's actually awesome.
Cross your fingers or something like that. No, I'm joking. But now I'm serious. So at the core of GDPR sits something called PIA, Privacy Impact Assessment. So no matter, and I sell technology, you know, for a living, but I would say don't start with technology, don't start with products and features. So don't get, amazed, you know, by the power of technology. Start with a PIA, Privacy Impact Assessment. Understand, comprehend, embrace, adapt and adopt, you know, the right.
Are you saying this is like a risk assessment of sorts?
some sort, understand the impact of misbehaving with the information. What's the tweak, if I may say, Mark? That, okay, you know, data lives in this very digital epoch. It lives everywhere. I mean, for a new appointed privacy officer, I would start with a question on, do you know where your data lives? Do you know where it is? And probably she or he says, well, yes, of course, you know, in my Exchange server and in a couple of clouds, in a couple of, okay, so welcome to the world of unstructured data. So not just structured data, unstructured data. Welcome to the world of shadow IT and shadow data. That basically means that you don't know where your information lives. So my suggestion for a newly appointed privacy officer, ask the right questions to the right people at the right time. Understand the impact. Understand where your data, the data life cycle, you know, where it goes back and forth. I would say, is it easy? Well, no, I understand it's complicated, but it's not impossible. That's something I'm always saying on my sessions. Is it difficult? Well, yes, it is. It's a very complicated world, you know, different storage devices and different storage platforms and clouds. Yeah, I understand all that, but it is not impossible. So actually there's technology around to make a sort of a radar or scanner just to get a structured data and unstructured data. From that moment on, then we'll talk about protocols and processes, procedures, technology, and everything. But first, the core, PIA, Privacy Impact Assessment. That would be my first.
You know, I'd love to ask you at some point in one of these webinars about your thoughts around AI, machine learning. I think we've got a spot for you coming up on that. We talk frameworks. Okay. But I think some of the things you just said, right, let's give some advice. And Kaya, I'm going to turn to you on this, is because we talked about data protection. We talked about, Ramses said, hey, here's all the things that we should consider. Are there any skills if I'm applying for, or if I'm a newly minted DPO, what are some skills you would suggest? And by the way, Veronica, I'm going to jump to my auditors here in a few minutes, because out of all this stuff, sooner or later, we got to prove that we're compliant. We got to audit this stuff. So Veronica, hang tight for a second. Kaya, what do you think are some skills I would need as a DPO?
I think, understanding what the business is and the needs, these are all very fundamental things. The thing that I see emerging in a lot of this regulation, there's actually criminal penalties. And for our local, private information regulatory legal framework, there are criminal penalties for disclosure. And the criminal penalties go to the chief, the data privacy officer. So having a good understanding of what those penalties are, of where it can go south, and pear-shaped is really important. But understanding the business, knowing the data that people are holding, the private information, where it's being kept, and when we get into unstructured data, like Ramses was talking about, it becomes an order of magnitude more complicated. Because how many of us really know where the organizational unstructured data resides? Nobody can really say.
We're still trying to figure it out, yeah.
Yeah, I had a call this morning with a client and that works for a global organization that uses social media for marketing, unstructured data all over the place globally. And if there's an inadvertent disclosure, these people can be held accountable and can go to jail. So, have a good lawyer, have a good criminal lawyer who understands this stuff. Very, very important. and the rest kind of flows from there, I think. At one point, I was looking at this kind of a position, being a virtual DPO for various companies. But after reviewing it for a while, I said, no, I don't think this is anything I want to be directly involved in or take personal responsibility for.
It's a lot of risk, right?
Yeah, it's just a lot of risk.
Yeah.
So that's really the challenge. That's in my mind.
That's interesting, because that takes me to Veronica. I'd mentioned you a minute ago. Is one of the things we haven't talked about up to this point is assurance, right? We haven't talked about audit because everybody wants to make sure we're following the rules, right? There's a lot of information out there. So I'm going to jump to this next question that says audit and assurance programs are still emerging out there, right? So what are your suggestions? Are there practices, frameworks, bodies of knowledge that you would suggest to any of our listeners? And then I'll open it up to the rest of the group. But I want to kick off with you, Veronica, because in my mind, and everybody on this panel agrees, you are the audit person on this panel. So we're going to put the pressure on you to give us some advice on this.
Thank you, Mark. Yes. So one thing auditors need to put in mind right now is we've been previously assessing security, but right now I believe auditors right now need to now to distinguish between assessing security and privacy. Well, the two overlap in the connected world, but we need now to start assessing privacy with an enterprise, an overall enterprise overview in our plans. So as we ensure to cut out privacy audits, we have to make sure that we've really accounted for privacy in our audit plans, because we are apparently reviewing the plans. So ensure your audit plan captures the privacy perspective, not only security, but privacy has also been considered in some way. Then also another thing I'd love to say is that organizations need to set up a compliance framework, because at the end of the day, when I come to audit your data compliance and everything, or to ensure that you're complying with the regulation, I need to see the framework you're using so as to ensure that you achieve the organization objectives. And also one key thing that we have to understand right now is creating data privacy awareness. If you do not educate employees, if you do not educate stakeholders of the kind of data they are collecting, the kind of data they are hosting, of course, you not achieve anything. So if everyone has it
Is it me? Did you guys lose Veronica?
Got updated yes. material for yeah. training your staff about data handling. You have a framework, like you have a framework in place.
I guess our network.
Yeah, Veronica, I think we lost you.
Okay, may I jump in while we are
waiting? Yeah, jump in, OPME. Please do.
Okay, so I agree with what Veronica said, you know, about ensuring that auditors today understand the overlap between privacy and security, and then the differences, and also the awareness, especially from a governance and management perspective. You know, it's part of governance requirements for organizations today. It's an enterprise risk management issue. Mm-hmm. And so at the board level, you know, there's a need for auditors to be able to provide that kind of assurance that the impact, you know, that you have looked at in your privacy impact assessments, you know, the consequences are well managed, and that the board is able to rely on the assurances provided by the auditors. So I think that in that sense, that is correct, you know.
Very good
perspective to look at.
So we got a question out there about. Oh, Veronica's out there. So hey, hang on just a second. I did get a question. I want you to finish what you were saying earlier. But we got a question, Turhan, who is actually a friend of many people on this panel. And Turhan says, "Hey, are there any mapping tables for the requirements of different global privacy acts? Keeping in mind that some of them conflict with each other." Right. So as I'm auditing, so Veronica, I'm going to go back to you. Maybe you can kind of hit some points on that. And I'm going to put it out to the panel, because we'll probably need to start wrapping up here in about 10 minutes or so.
All right. Yes. So as an auditor, I would advise you use the right frameworks that add value to your role and the business as well. So I'll recommend the COPIT framework. It has quite a number of tools and resources, and guidance for IT governance and for IT governance. And I also would wish to recommend the IT risk framework. It's a complement to COBIT, And this framework will help your enterprise identify, govern, and manage IT risks from an end-to-end comprehensive view of all risks. And lastly, there are quite a number of frameworks, but I would prefer mentioning only these ones. I'll also recommend the ITAP framework. It is designed as a living document. It consists of compliance and good practice. It's actually a very good framework for auditors. So as you're planning to audit your privacy, as you're planning to audit or carry out your privacy audit, ensure that you choose the right frameworks that are suitable for your role and for your organization. So what I was trying to mention earlier, Mark, as I was kicked out, I was saying, if we all consider privacy as a basic human right, of course, all of us will have the responsibility to keep it right. So back to you, Mark.
Nope, that makes a lot of sense. So we got a couple other questions out here. So is it possible, is that possible for balancing between GDPR and our governmental data privacy law in our country? I think somebody answered that one. Kaya asked, where are they from? So here's another question. Globally, the data protection laws seem to be more inclined towards the private sector. Where should the balance be for government entities collecting and processing private data? I think we may have hit that one, I think, earlier. Do you guys agree with that one?
Yep.
I think we...
Yeah. Agree.
Yeah, I think we kind of covered that one. So what I heard you say, that there are a lot of frameworks out there. You guys know, anybody on this call knows, I'm a huge fan of COBIT. I think it's a very versatile framework, but I think there's a lot of others out there that make sense. And I think what we all agree on right now is there's not a single global framework that covers all of our privacy concerns right now. I do know that there are multiple, I'm throwing this in, nobody was expecting this, but I do know there are additional new privacy certifications popping up everywhere. ISACA just launched a new privacy engineer certification. There's a lot of those. What are your thoughts on these? Or do these make sense? And do privacy certifications make you feel better that the professionals working in your organization are more keen to privacy if they're certified in a privacy certification?
I guess there has been many certifications for data protection officer qualifications and training, and I guess the new training will be awesome. I went through some literature about it, and I think it will be an added value. Especially, it will make the audience more familiar with data mapping techniques and data protection impact assessment obligations from DPO perspective, and especially how you can build the privacy and security within this course.
Absolutely, Mark. And, you know, to the point earlier about what a new DPO should be doing, you know, one of the key things, obviously, is having the right people on board to be able to manage their privacy, efforts. So getting people with the right skills and qualifications is obviously critical to that. And I do think ISACA's new privacy, I forget how we're going to call it, CDPSE. I'm not sure what the shortened name is going to be.
So I did hear, so the ISACA CEO at North America CAC yesterday, I think he called it CDPSE.
CDPSE, yeah, that's what I'm hearing as well.
I think that's what he called it. Yeah.
So I think that's going to be a really important part of it. It's going to play an important role in this, particularly given ISACA's global breadth, with other certifications already. So I'm certainly looking forward to seeing how this progresses. And yeah, absolutely essential to have the right people, the right skills in place.
Mark,
I saw some news today that the CISSP is being considered as equivalent to a master's degree.
Wow.
So yeah, I don't see any ISACA certifications yet there, but the ISC squared is doing obviously some work there. I think exam-based certifications have a half-life is what I'm seeing, because to maintain, I don't know that an exam is sufficient to maintain relevance in this planet, on this earth that we live on. I think it needs to be more action-based certifications, kind of showing a specific set of qualifications and knowledge. I don't know that an exam with TP requirements to keep it ongoing is relevant. I mean, when I passed the CISSP, I guess it was about 14, 15 years ago, the questions were, the knowledge was very, very different than it is today. Today, there's a lot of questions about legal and industrial property, patents, trademarks, things like that. Had nothing to do with what was going on 14 years ago. There was a lot of stuff about mainframes in there. So the nature, the body of knowledge changes, and I think people have to keep up with the body of knowledge. And a lot of the present, the big certifications today, whether it's ESACA certifications or other organizational certifications, I don't think they keep up with the body of knowledge that well. That's the big lack. And I don't know what the answer is to that, to be honest with you, but I see that's what's missing.
Go ahead, Ramses.
Yeah, well, thank you, Mark. I just wanted to say that I remember well my precious times at the board of directors with ESACA, some of it with esteemed and dear colleagues that are present in this panel. But I remember well the discussions of, you know, going with cybersecurity and privacy, and then the decision was cybersecurity, and then look at ESACA now, you know, CSX and the foundations and fantastic knowledge on cybersecurity. So when I saw CDPC, you know, the acronym, I said, now it was time. It was already time. So when you've built great foundations and a great cathedral on cybersecurity after having done it on governance and auditing and assurance, so when I saw it and I said, wow, I thought it was time. So, but just an interesting thought is it's being sold and advertised and show your technical expertise, show that you are a pro from a technical perspective. So it's very interesting because CDPC, meaning, I mean, the last letter of the acronym is an E, is E. Engineer. So it's not a manager or an auditor, it's an engineer. So I absolutely celebrate and I applaud the approach after having built for years and in a great fashion on cybersecurity and the rest of the things, governance of the enterprise IT and auditing assurance, you know, privacy, of course, and given the times that we are living, of course, and this webinar has been, it is a proof of that. So I just applaud it. And the engineer technically, practical guidance, I would say that's something that is deserved out there.
I agree, and I think what we saw when cybersecurity became, you know, front and center to everything we did 3 years ago, after in the U.S. it was after the Target breach, and that was more than 3 years ago. But and then do you look at organizations, esteemed organizations like the IIA, Institute of Internal Auditors, right, who are creating similar types of certifications around this, and we're going to start to see a flood of these things in the market. Most people here that are on this call are part of both of those organizations, as well as many out there. But I think we're going to see a flood of more privacy certifications that are coming up out there. Hey guys, I'm going to keep moving on. I think this next question, we've already talked a little bit about standards and we've talked about common themes we should be aware of. But since we're getting very close to the end of this, what I want to do, if you guys are okay, I'm going to jump into this and I'm going to go around the panel. And I think it's time for us to, you know, we've talked about a lot of stuff out here. I would like to go around the panel and get what your top suggestions are. If I'm a privacy professional, if I'm a CEO, if I'm a chief audit executive, whatever my role, take your expertise and give me your top tips. And by the way, Kaya, I'm going to start with you because you're the first face I see on my Zoom. What would be your top tips you would provide to me as an organization based on what we've talked about today?
I think realize that these requirements are changing. They're dynamic. Nothing is written in stone. Everything is always changing. You know, 6 months ago, pre-COVID-19, privacy requirements, I think, in terms of online participation in these kinds of events was very different than they are today. I think this is pretty much the only game in town now, remote access and webinars, and people have to be able to share their private information. I think 6 months ago, it was much more, people were much more challenged by sharing their information. So that's an example. It's just everything is dynamic. We have to really know the nature of the information we're changing, who we're sharing it with, and how those people are going to use it. That really, those three questions, I think, are fundamental to it. And the rest comes out of answering those three questions in my mind.
I think that makes total sense. So, hey, Ed, you have anything to add to what Kaya just said?
So preparing for privacy in the post-pandemic. Get ready to defend the decisions that were made during the pandemic. Acknowledge that this is an actual business issue. A lot of the times it's like, oh, well, that's an IT thing. Well, no, this is actually a business issue. And we have to have those adult discussions around why this is important, not only now during the pandemic when we're working remotely, or we're collecting that information to identify and track the virus, but how we're going to move forward from it.
You got it. Hey, Alan, what about you in the UK?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say remain vigilant. You know, unfortunately, we're seeing a massive uptick on cybercrime, whether it's ransomware or malware attacks, etc. So, you know, people who work in this risk security assurance area, remain vigilant. Convince your business leaders that you have a very important role to play right now and as we come out of this as well.
You got it. Sounds good. Alain, what about you?
I would suggest to the companies to think globally. When we talk about privacy, it's not, as it was mentioned, it's not an IT thing. Most of the time, the first question I have is, what is the best tool to ensure privacy? Well, it's not a question of tool. Privacy is about protection of private data, and data are everywhere. They are, on IT supports, but also in the heads of the people, on papers, and everywhere. So, first of all, think globally, and then appoint somebody who will be in charge of that. And these people must have a global, a holistic view of the enterprise. So these people need to be at the executive level, not inside the IT department.
You got it. I mean, that's great advice. So far, so good, guys. Hey, I'm going to go to you, Dr. Ramsey and Jordan, next.
Basically, keep evaluating your cybersecurity resilience program. Keep improving your vulnerability management program as well. Be aware of phishing attacks. The number of cyber attacks has been increased rapidly since March until today. So be aware of phishing and potential fraud.
Let's go to Barcelona. What do you say, Ramses?
Oh, thank you, Mark. Well, my top suggestions, if I may, let me say three. So top suggestion, my top three is, these are moments of showing leadership. And I'm looking straight into the camera and hopefully everybody see me. These are the moments of showing leadership, all right? So taking care of people, understanding, you know, the things that are happening, right? On the triad, you know, that we always say people, process, and technology, etc. So leadership was one of my peaks on the triangle. The other one is use technology. Well, yes, probably is the technologies to me that I like technology, but especially when everybody now is working from home and they say that in the new paradigm, 60% of the people will do smart working, which basically means going back to the office once per week or twice per week only. So they call it the smart working. That's 60%, Mark, but means that the other 40% will never go back to the office. So I am saying that because, wow, that's another shift in perception. So use technology, advanced authentication, make sure that it's the right people accessing the right information. Use encryption. Let me go back to GDPR for 30 seconds. It is written in the law, black over white, encrypt, encrypt, encrypt. It's mentioned, if I recall correctly, no less than 7 times. So encrypt, encrypt, encrypt. That's my second suggestion. My third one, get ready for a change in culture. So the expectations will change and those smart workers or home workers forever. So when we talk about people, process, and technology as a triad, I always say another triangle on top of that, which is culture, structure, and strategy. So talking about the culture, get ready for a cultural change, different expectations, different approaches. So leadership, use of technology, and of course, get ready to understand the culture and the change. Hey,
Ramses, I know you are also an expert in machine learning, in intelligence. I know you wanted to push this into what we talked about today, but what I'd like to do is reserve your expertise on machine learning and AI for when we talk about cybersecurity next week, because I think you could add some really good information out there.
Pleasure.
You got it. Hey, Dina, out of the Middle East, let's go to you.
Yeah, actually two things, Mark. First of all, we have to review and assess how we were working and doing during the pandemic environment and the pandemic period. What are the lessons learned? What were the challenges? And based on that, we have to build our privacy strategy, maybe aligned with the cybersecurity strategy and our other strategies in the organization. Get top management commitment, as just Ramses said, I totally agree with you. In this strategy, we have to look into our stakeholders, just what are the tools that are required, the challenges, the skills. From that, we can definitely, if in case we just go into the same situation again, we will be prepared with this strategy and the skills we already have.
I totally agree with you. Opiemi, let's jump to you in Nigeria. Veronica, you'll go last because you're our auditor, our third line of defense. Opiemi, to you first.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mark. I just want to speak to, especially to people listening from my region, that we need to step up to a higher standard beyond what the environment requires of us, because mostly privacy is driven by compliance. And if you don't have regulators that are strong enough to enforce it, people tend not to focus so much on it. So we need to go beyond what is required to what is excellent, you know, what are the best practices globally, and ensure that we localize that. Thank you.
You got it. Oh, and that actually leads in quite nicely to our assurance auditor, Veronica. Tell us what you think.
Thank you, Mark. Yes, this goes to auditors, that we should be wary of the emerging technology trends and their impacts to the privacy. Remember right now, most organizations that dealing with, we've been dealing with take your own device home. No, bring your own device at work. But now organizations are dealing with take our device home. So how is data handled even in the household? So let us be wary of how data is handled. And as we are planning or replanning our audit plans, let us ensure that we've really captured data privacy as from the entire organization's perspective. Back to you, Mark.
Very good. Thank you very much, everybody. You might notice there's a Karen Covington Yao down there. Karen is not one of the panelists. She's our tech. I drug her into this as our tech support. So it looks like we've had very good tech support. Karen, thank you so much for everything you've done to help get this set up. Karen is one of those folks that you didn't see much and you didn't hear much, but Karen actually made this happen for us. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your kind attention in this webinar. In a couple of days, this webinar will be available to you on the cloud. I'll have information out on this. It takes a little bit of time for Zoom to be able to render this, and you should be able to view this again if you desire. A link will be shared once that's available online. Join us next week. Many of you that are on this call today, you are already signed up for next week's focus, which is cybersecurity. We'll have the same type of discussion, but I think we'll get into a little bit more about some of the laws, regulations, and how we balance the privacy things that we talked about today with cybersecurity. And of course, we'll wrap this up on Wednesday, May 27th with one of my favorite topics, which is IT governance systems. And we'll really wrap that up with frameworks and how you might be able to put together an overarching framework for your organization. Ladies and gentlemen, I know we did not hit every one of your questions, but again, like I said before, you have the opportunity to reach out directly to any of these panelists. This is a non-sponsored event. Everyone here is your friend. And everyone here is your consultant and your guide, as well as you are for us. I appreciate everybody joining. I will see you next week. Keep an eye out on social media. Every one of these panelists are crazy about their social media. And we have a huge response today. Thank you for joining, everyone. And we'll see you next Wednesday. Thanks, all.